Welcome back to the Jacobswell Podcast. This week on the School of Unlearning, we've been going through the series of Job. And when we find ourselves in these seasons of such pain, we need people. We need the kind of people who will come alongside and mourn with us and be there for us. But sometimes what we get instead are some well-meaning, but mistake-ridden friends. What do we do? How do we deal with this? How do we journey with people and enter into their pain in a way that expresses real and honest love? So let's get started. Good morning.
And good morning to you.
And welcome to the brand new Jacobswell
Podcast Studio. We are podcast live studio. From the Jacobswell Podcast Studio.
Definitely not live. Definitely recorded.
No, we're not live. Yes.
Not live from the Jacobswell Podcast Studios.
It happened, people. We've been through a journey. We got displaced.
We are nomadic.
We are.
We have been moved. And moved and moved.
So many times. And then, the school decided that they're just going to pop up and
take all our stuff
and literally destroy our room. It no longer exists.
It does not exist. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
And then we just spent the last, 2 months in my office.
Yes.
All the podcast gear. And every time I've had a meeting for the last 2 months, people have awkwardly come in and tried to rearrange all the microphones so they could find a place to sit. It was really good.
It was not optimal. It was not fair to Shua in any way. Well, now we are in this glorified closet.
Yes.
That is perfect, I think. Good. Perfect, perfect strong.
It's real. It's real good.
It's real good.
Our needs.
It's real good. Real good.
It was a copier room.
Hey, ain't nothing wrong with this room.
And then our facilities guy, Tim, had a brilliant idea. And he's like, hey, why don't we just this thing's half as big as it needs to be.
Yeah, this was our second copy room, and what it was a junk collection room. It's like the junk drawer in your house. Every house needs a junk drawer.
Imagine lots of cupboards filled with sometimes nothing.
Stuff that is a little too good to throw away.
Yeah.
There's an off chance that maybe sometime someone...
Save it for the garage sale.
The Jacobswell garage sale coming soon.
Oh, don't even offer that.
Every time we go to do a fundraising thing, we can have a garage sale. Oh, that's my soul.
Would you like this? It's 30 cents.
It's 30 cents for the Lord,
Paul drank out of this cup himself.
Yes, that's right. Oh my goodness.
But we're here and we've got four walls
and deeply grateful.
We are grateful.
Awesome. It is
a
awesome.
Nice little cozy
space.
It's
the best we've had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's ours.
Yes.
And as far as we know, we're not getting kicked out.
So, rescue staff, keep your grubby hands off. No, it's actually not like that at all. We're going to sip some coffee now.
We could make it like that. A little battle royale kind of a thing.
We could put a sign, do not enter. That means you.
And then we're going to put names underneath.
Yeah. Care department, formation department.
Of all of the people.
Youth department.
In this church who cause problems, the care department.
They're the worst.
Number one.
They are the worst. And you'd think they'd be caring. Do better, Amanda. Do better.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. This is good. You know, you can tell when we've had a couple of weeks from the podcast.
We have. And you should know, it's my fault because I got COVID, which I guess is not my fault. I had COVID. And for like 2 weeks, I was like,
sense of this in real time.
Yes. So that's why you haven't heard from us of late. And then we were going to do the podcast last week and then our schedules got all mixed up. And it was going to be Brian because Brian spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brian had a week. So we're back.
Here we are.
Here we are. Yes. On this sunny but chilly day. I love this weather.
Okay. I was just about to say, it's kind of perfect.
It is. It's warm enough that I'm having my coffee on my porch overlooking the lake every morning. Coffee just tastes better when it's a little chilly and the dog is there. And
I feel bad for people who don't get that.
Mm-mm.
Like people who need it. So my ideal is like 60 to 75.
Yep. Like 80 if I'm going to swim.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But as far as like a day that I'd like to just be outside and enjoy it, that's like kind of prime for me. And I know some people want it hotter than that, but then there's this like this lovely, it's a little bit cooler than that, but it's not winter temperatures.
No.
It's like, it's brisk and you feel alive. And
well, you enjoy campfires in the evening. And
for our listeners who don't live in this part of the country,
we're sorry
that you don't live here.
Yes. They hate us because they ain't us.
Get it together. Moved to
Eau Claire. No. So most people can't do the winters, and that's the big breaking thing. And I like that because it keeps the riffraff out, right? Keeps the population low.
I think the message that was just said is we actually don't want you here.
That's probably closer to where my heart is on this.
This is ours.
This is ours. Love it. Stay away. Oh, we're man. So bad. Yes. I don't
hey,
know.
It's good. We got through weather.
We did.
That's really good. Okay. Yeah. So I told you I wasn't going to tell you what I thought until we started recording.
All right. Of the message this
yes.
weekend.
Yes. Really good job.
Thanks.
Really, really good job.
Well, thanks.
You always do such a nice job, but there are certain messages that I'm like,
okay, 30 chapters of Job, you mean, in one sermon?
Hot dang. Like, no, this one was really good. Like, we've joked around a bit in the past about, like, you could write a book off of this
right.
one. But this one, the relevance of it, and I was, you know, a lot of times on Sunday mornings when I'm leading worship, I don't often get to engage with the sermon in real time. There's right. too much going through my brain in the middle of service, and but I had people coming back into the green room. A couple of them just like, whoa,
yeah,
this is a good one. This yeah. is a real good one. I was like, okay. And then I heard a couple of comments and I got to really sit with it this morning. And it just powerful and relevant. And I think just such a great way of making sense of the overarching story of this book and be like, oh, why are these relationships even included? Why are right. they so important? And you start to see and you're like, oh man.
Right.
Anyway, I just wanted you to know.
Thank you.
I thought this one was very exceptional.
I appreciate that. And I think, you know, a message like the one this weekend, I mean, just taps into first a felt need, something people feel very deeply. And then it has what you'd call cathartic power. So when something is cathartic, it pulls together a bunch of things and shows the interconnectedness and then shows, oh, that is it. That's why I'm feeling this way. That matches my experience. That resonates a lot. And I think that this message was able to do that because it's a message about the isolation of pain. The opening illustration, just talking about pain being like on your own little private deserted island. Mm-hmm. And it's yours and no one else can come on it. And anybody who tries to come up on it is intruding. And that's what pain, suffering, grief, loss feels like. It feels isolating. And it's a conflicting thing in that the isolation is something in one respect that's been done to you. It's something you create. It's something you want. It's something you hate. I mean, so it's like, please come, stay away. It's something that we, in some respects, hate because it's hard and painful, but we also cherish. It's a place where we're asking lots of questions, but we don't really want anyone to answer our questions. And we want to be seen. We want what has happened to us to be validated and appreciated for the depth of what it was, but we don't want anybody to see us like this. And so it's emotional, it's cerebral, and it's what makes this thing of coming alongside a hurting person such a challenge. When we're really hurting, when we're really grief, you know, struck, when we are trying to make sense of pain, when we're in that in-between place where there's some bitterness and sadness and numbness and all those kinds of things, it's just really hard to be with a person like that because for two reasons. One is the reality is there's not much you can do for that person except for be with that person. And keep the bridge open. And, you know, we want to be able to say the right thing mm-hmm. and do the right thing and
fix
and yeah. solve the right problem. And we want to walk on their island and say, we get this. We understand. We can share this with you. And we can't. I mean, that's the thing about pain and suffering is that even if there's another person who's gone to something very similar, it's not their it's not their thing. This happened to me. I mean, of all the suffering in the world, of all the pain in the world, and very often we say things like that, it's just look around and you've got a lot better than most people. But yeah, but that invalidates what I'm experiencing. And so the temptation to be a lousy friend, a ham-handed friend, a misguided friend is profound. And that's what you see in the book of Job. You see Job, of course, literally sitting on the ashes of his life. Things are burnt down. All his animals are dead. His kids are dead. His wife, he's isolated. His you know, his marriage is not a point of comfort or strength. He is alone and he's just there. And you have these three friends. You end up with four friends eventually. And there's a lot interesting about the fourth friend. But these three friends roll up. And these are people who are used to thinking about Job as, you know, the guy of wisdom, the enviable one, the one who has it all together, the one who you would say something like, oh, if you don't know what to do, do what Job would do. You know, you want to see what wisdom looks like? Job's the dude. You know, you want to see what it looks like to have, be a blessed and fortunate guy? Job. You need some advice? Go talk to Job. And the passage starts wonderfully. Job has just had this interaction with his wife. He just lost everything. And it says his three friends communicated together. Hey, we're going to go as a group and we're going to comfort him. We're going to give him sympathy and comfort. And then they roll up and it says they didn't even recognize him. Mm-hmm. And what I felt and saw in that, in this round of studying Job for me personally, is just how deeply unsettling that would have been for Job's friends. Right. Because, and this is one of the things that makes us miss the mark when we're trying to comfort friends. We don't realize how much of what we're saying, doing, and responding is actually about us and not about the person we're trying to help. Mm-hmm. So here they are. They got now, okay, this suffering of this person. Very often it's harder to see, this is particularly true if it's like your children or someone you love, watch them suffer and trying to make sense of what it means. And it just challenges them multiple places. There's nothing we can do. What are we supposed to say? What does this mean? I mean, so not only does this challenge Job's theology and his view of God, what does it mean for their theology? Because this doesn't fit their paradigm. Mm-hmm. And so it creates these subtle crises of faith. In addition to that, you know, you have, whenever you see another person suffering, it's a bridge to your suffering. So the whole science of empathy is fabulous and fascinating and horrifying all at the same time. It's this understanding of what happens in your brain. So you go through a trauma, maybe as a very young child, something that just, you know, the day you found out your father died, the day you got beat up or some sort of type of thing. Those traumatic events create a pathway through your neurons, through neuroinhibitors in your brain, a literal pathway. And I mean literally, literally. And I don't mean literally like some people mean literally. They mean literally figuratively, and they say it's literally. But
wow,
this is a pet peeve of mine. The other day someone said, I heard him say this, that guy was literally full of crap. And I thought, wow, why did he go to the doctor for that? Or because that's literally true. That's a bad day for that dude. Anyway, sorry. Maybe we should edit that part out. I don't know.
Oh, no, it's good stuff.
It's good stuff. So
have you seen, have you watched Parks and Recreation?
Oh, yeah.
That show?
Yeah.
Like the Chris Traeger character who's always like, literally.
Nope. Not literally. Nope. Anyway.
My body is literally a microchip.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You mean figuratively. Anyway, there's actually some really theological significance to this whole conversation, which we won't chase today, but because we tend to think things are literal and they're figurative and creates all kinds of problems. Mm. Anyway, there's a pathway in our brain. And when something comes that looks the same, smells the same, feels the same, unsettles us or makes us feel afraid in the same way, that in some way reminds us, in our brains, we walk that path again. So we re-experience it as though it's happening again. And the deeper trauma, the deeper the pain. Now, currently, the current understanding of how to treat this, interestingly enough, is counterintuitive to what we want to do. What we want to do is forget it, push it away, keep ourselves from putting in any, being any situations where we feel that again. But it turns out that the current research is telling us what you do is actually get really close to it, which makes sense of everything we're saying about Job and lament and emotionally healthy relationships, that you walk down that path, you remember those things, you deconstruct, you don't deconstruct them. You learn to say, okay, that happened to me when I was a child and I was vulnerable. I'm not a child and vulnerable anymore. And you walk past it enough that you're not scared of it anymore. It's like when you're a kid and you're afraid to go in the basement. The answer ultimately is to go into the basement and realize there's really nothing in the basement that's going to hurt me. And now I've been in the basement 100 times. I don't have any problem going down the basement. And so you get closer to it and it loses its power to jump out and terrify you. So this is a counterintuitive thing. So if you're not in touch with that kind of thinking, emotional intelligence, emotional healing, spiritual healing, because again, this is why the Bible, you know, speaks so much about this. There's a fascinating story. I don't know if we talked about this or not, but I need to do a message on this sometimes because just in my heart and my mind about that story, I may even talk about this weekend, we'll see. But about the story of Moses and the children of Israel, they sin, snakes come up, and everybody gets bit by snakes, and everybody's dying in the camp. So they call out to God, they call to God, Moses intervenes, and God says the most strange thing. He says, okay, I'm going to break one of my rules. I'm going to ask you to make a graven image of this snake. And then you put on a pole, walk through the camp. Anybody who looks at that will live. What a weird story. And then, of course, later it's affiliated with Christ in John chapter 3 and an admonition to look at the pain of Christ as a means of healing. Mm-hmm. But there's a deep and profound psychological truth there that looking at the thing that hurt you, being honest with the thing that hurt you, whether it was done to you or you were one of the ones who grumbled and you're directly involved, or you were the ones who were just there and you got, but looking at the thing that hurt you, there's a path to healing in that and doing it in a healthy, safe way. So if you don't have that and you roll up to try to help someone who's on their island of pain, not realizing that on some level, you're in your own island of pain. There's two people, and both are dangerous in different ways. One is the person who has been hurt deeply, who hasn't made sense of that, and who's drawn to other people's hurt because it's kind of a backdoor way of kind of processing and feeling their own stuff.
Yeah.
The other person who's dangerous is a person who hasn't been through a lot. Mm-hmm. Honestly, they've had kind of a charmed life, and so they just roll up, and they don't have those pathways. They don't have those pathways of empathy. Now, the beautiful thing about empathy is that it's what connects us in terms of our humanity. It what allows us to feel what another person feels. You know, so both you and I are fathers. So when you were new youth guy, right, you got kids, you loved kids, you were amazing with kids, and then you had a kid. And all of a sudden you started having empathy with parents about why they freak out about their kids. And then, you know, we're fathers together and there's a thing now we share. There's a pathway when you saw your child born, I saw my child born, different children, you know, but the point is that it connects our humanity. And so empathy is central to this thing. It's a deeper form of, you know, the word, I didn't look up the Hebrew word, but the word that's in the English about Job's friends, they wanted to bring comfort and sympathy, you know, and what they needed to start with was empathy to understand, you know, and sometimes we think because we have empathy, we understand that they're not the same thing because again, no matter how close your struggle is to their struggle, it's not the same struggle. Mm-hmm. So it both is a place of a bridge to walk across empathy, but it's also a cautionary tale of don't say, I get it. Let me tell you my story. Let me explain why mine was worse. Let me whatever. And so very often people who show up as they start processing that way. And so empathy, when it is felt and received, becomes the bridge that we can walk across. Compassion is a little different. Compassion is literally the word for compassion is in the Greek New Testament is to suffer with. That I'm willing to go and I'm willing to just be with you and suffer. So I'm not here to fix your problem, not here to just encourage you to stand outside and gawk because there's that too. Mm-hmm. I'm here to just sit in the ashes and the dirt and suffer with you, to make your pain my pain. And if that means I relive some of my pain, I mean, that's an unsettling thing. That's what makes it such an important thing for self-care. For anybody in any kind of care ministry, whether you're a pastor or a social worker or a counselor or a teacher, where you're regularly experiencing the trauma of another person, And particularly if you've got significant trauma in your own life, you know, that you take time to talk, to pray, to lament, to rest, to not always be in those intense, white hot, you know, situations of feeling that trauma that, you know, not only is it a new kind of trauma, it makes you relive your trauma. And so whenever we go to help someone, wherever we pull up to their island, we should not walk on their island in a presumptuous way of saying, I understand, I can own this, I can fix this, I can do whatever, all the things we do. We just from the boat, it, you know, to extend the metaphor, which is not a literal metaphor, it's a figurative metaphor. to just be, to sit, you know, but what do we want to do? We don't like the way their pain makes us feel. Mm-hmm. So we want, and very often we feel like, I just want them to feel better. Well, why do you want them to feel better? Just honestly, why do you want them to feel better? Well, because them not feeling better, how can I feel better if they don't feel better?
Yeah.
You know, and this is why a lot of people really rally early when people are going through trauma, and then they disappear. Because what they really wanted to do was solve it, give an easy answer, get resolve it in such a way that they can keep their simplistic views of pain and suffering in place.
Or maybe also just deal with whatever, maybe guilt or shame they're feeling.
Or not of, deal with it.
Well, sure. But even that sense of like, oh no, this bad thing happened. I need to at least extend my sympathies.
Yes.
And then, okay, I did that. I checked the box. And mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you're out. Can I was thinking about that image of when they first see him.
Yes.
And they just start weeping and raising their voices.
They're great friends at that point.
Right. And then, yeah, the way it kind of follows with that 7 days of just being with him.
Yep.
But it does remind me of the shock of, I guess the image that comes to my mind is when you go to the hospital and you visit somebody you really care about.
Yep.
And you see them in a different state than you're used to.
Yep.
Rather than strong and capable, they're broken and they're maybe hooked up to, you know. And that imagery does kind of put me in that place of how on edge it puts you as the visitor and how you realize that this person that you care about, that you have connected to and talked to so many times in the past, all of a sudden you're not quite sure how to speak.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Well, and it gets more complicated too when there's a relationship dynamic where there's some level of responsibility. So a parent, I remember this, there was a distinct role that lasted for me about 10 years of shifting over to start caring for my father to the point that at the end I was doing his finances and, you know, making big decisions about, you know, you sit down with mom and mom didn't do that, you know? So, you know, you take on this role and this person who's always been like the paragon of strength in your young mind as a kid, always there, always having the answers, just you were a little afraid of them. You deeply loved them. But now all of a sudden they're this very fragile person who counting on you. Mm-hmm. It's also part of the natural development of a truly maturing person. It's the unsettling nature of when you outgrow someone. Mm. And this is a very complicated thing, but it's a very important thing to understand. So like when you realize maybe that I know stuff my parents didn't know, or I know something a mentor didn't know. I remember distinctly when we were at this church, and the church, we were very young, we just started really growing, and a guy who was like a spiritual mentor to me, just a giant in my life, who I went to was always there. It was always me receiving from him. We were walking around the church after service, and he was asking me all these questions about how I was doing things and what I was doing so that he could implement them and help other pastors. It was so unsettling to me. It's like,
you're supposed to have the answers.
Yes, what happened here? And so when you don't understand what's going on inside of you and you have another place to deal with that, then on some level, what you do for other people becomes about you and not about them. So you see this so often, so clumsily done. A person who is hurting and you go and you tell, you know, some of the things you see in Job's friends, you tell them how you feel, how they should feel.
Yeah. I also like, sure. I appreciated that you had said too, like when you enter into those things, you find yourself stumbling. And I think that's good for people here too, is as we're trying to deconstruct this and make sense of it, also just acknowledging these situations are incredibly awkward.
Yep.
And they're all unique. Like you said, you,
no other person's pain that you have stepped into in the past is going to be quite like the one you're stepping into today. And so I appreciated you saying that, because I think having a little bit of grace for, you're probably going to mess this up.
Yeah. and it'll be okay. I mean, you know, as long as you don't just go in and do a Job's Friends where, you know, Job's Friends start with, it's an interesting thing because at first they're kind of, you know, not too bad. They're like, can I just say some stuff? There's just some stuff. And they say, so, you know,
please don't be offended. Yeah,
please don't be offended. You know, but who cannot, who can let this go? Well, you should let it go. And most of the time, you know, don't be afraid of saying things like, I don't know, I don't understand. And just, I love you, you know, and just, you know, we want to do something, say something. And just to stay in that awkwardness, keep reaching out. You know, I called him every day this week and I said, how are you doing? And, you know, even that question, I've had people in the past ask, yell at me, say, please don't ask me that question anymore. I'm doing horrible, you know? And honestly, there are times they've been a little unreasonable. They've been hurtful. It's just like, and they're pushing you away. But part of them is saying, please don't leave.
Yeah.
You know? And so to deal with a person in that state is kind of, oh, enduring. And there's so many issues here. The issues of, you know, is this tapping me into my pain? Do I have an image of myself that I'm the helpful person who's going to save people? You know, is that being blown up? You know, so a lot of people, I've talked to people who went out to help someone, and because for whatever reason, the person they're trying to help, they can't receive it from them. They don't want it from them. You're not the person. They get hurt by that. You know, I came to help and they wouldn't let me help. And that hurts them. Well, then it becomes, well, why did you need to help? I mean, why did you need them? You know, and I hear this a lot with parents who, you know, they'll come and they'll say, you know, their kid will set up an appointment with me, like talking through college or something like that. You just happened with youth pastor. And I'll say two or three things or ask two or three things, and they'll just get energy and excitement and focus. And I'll talk with the parents that week and said, yeah, I said the same thing to them. And their little chip on the shoulder thing. And what I always tell parents then is, well, they just needed to hear from another person so that they could own it. And the other thing is that the stakes are really high with you. So it's hard to receive from you right now, but that it won't always be like that. And it's actually a compliment that they just love you so much. And they so respect you that it's just hard. So all this is, if you can get past how this is making me feel, how this is blowing up my paradigms, how this is making me feel things I don't want to feel again, then you can be that presence. And it's interesting because it's not that you don't say anything. A lot of it's timing and a lot of it's invitation, you know, that people will come back and say, well, what do you think about this? Or I think this, this, and this. And very often the temptation then is even to answer the question. What I've learned to do is just redirect the question back to them. Well, why do you say that? Or what's making you feel this way? Or why do you think that's a good plan of action? Or what have you learned? Or what do you think? Because what most people need is just time and process. They need to do what Job's doing. Just vomit all this out. Some of it's out of balance. Some of it isn't. Some of it's what I feel. Some of it's what I think. You know, and so the more you can just help people express to get to the point that they can bring some of the rationality to it and they can start piecing things together, you know, and to be super patient, because we want people to move faster than they can, you know, so we can get on with life, you know, and that's a tough thing because, you know, that old trite counselor line, it'll take as long as it takes. Mm-hmm. How long are we going to be doing this? It'll take as long as it takes, you know, well, when will I get better? You know, you know, it'll take as long as it takes. And, you know, the one of the most beautiful lines that my therapist said to me years ago, when I was in a really dark place, because I started feeling pressure, even from some well-meaning people were kind of looking at me like, come on, let's get this together. It's time. Yeah. We've moved on. Time to get on. You know, other people, it's not as bad as other people have experienced. The therapist, the kind line she said to me is, listen, God does not expect you to move faster than you can. Mm. If you were a child learning to walk, because you're really learning to walk again, a profound and deep loss, trauma, however it expresses itself, depression, you're learning to walk again. You know, it's as though you had a stroke or something. And if you were a small child, and a small child, so you don't spank the child or yell at the child or shame the child for not being able to walk. You celebrate every step. And so just that metaphor of God not being disappointed with me that I couldn't do more in a day, that I could only work till 2 o'clock. So I just can't do anything else. And my brain's fuzzy and I just, exhausted, you know, or that, you know, that, you know, there's always more to do when you're a pastor. That's true of almost everybody's job. But I mean, you can always make one more phone call. You can express care one more time. You can almost say another prayer. You can always write your sermon a little better. So it's a never done kind of thing. It's not a checklist. We have to make 400 widgets and then we're done. So that kind of compassion, that kind of wisdom, and it was wonderful, you know, because she became a friend, certainly, but she was detached from it in a way that's a beautiful thing about therapy is she comes in, she sits, she doesn't own it, but she just creates a place where you can safely express things. So all of that is very good. So Job's friends are not that. It's interesting in the book of Job that it becomes more and more adversarial. And Job's not having any of it. I mean, he just does not, mm-hmm. you know, buy any. His sense of, in spite of all the pain, sense of self, sense of, I'm not going to agree to things that are just nonsense. I mean, there's a reason why at the end of the day, Job's the hero of this story and God affirms Job. And that it says, Job never missed the mark here. Mm-hmm. And yet he needed to repent, which is an interesting thing we can talk about. The you know, the thing is, because Job went through this and he questioned, he pushed, he expressed his emotions, his grief. And then when these bad friends started coming and accusing him and making it personal and doing shame narratives and all those things, he would not receive that. You know, he was not saying, you know, God, I think you're bad and you're evil and you don't have a plan. You don't love me. He's saying, I guess I still believe all that stuff enough that I can say all these things and trust that you're not going to throw me away. That because you are loving, I can say these things. Because you do have a plan, I can question the plan. Because you are good, I'm not questioning it, I'm counting on it. And so, you know, the person who won't express how they're honestly doing to God, ultimately it's a faith question that, do you really believe God's good? Do you really believe that God's going to stick with you? Or that is he the kind of vindictive God, thin-skinned guy up there that if you say these things, you're going to say, no one talks to me like that and smites you or something like that, which is the theology of Job's friends. So, yeah. So you have these three friends and they become, again, much more aggressive. And if you closely look at what they are saying, that, you know, I oversimplified and summarized their message. They were saying four things that we say, and we don't realize we say it all the time. All the time. That was absolute language, which you shouldn't use. We often do this. The first one is don't feel that way. We invalidate people's feelings. You know, we can do it in all kinds of hidden ways. We can do it in such a way where we say, oh, you're not looking at this clearly, or, you know, stay positive about this, or, you know, we'll do things like, you know, you shouldn't look at it this way. Sometimes we'll even say the lines, oh, don't feel that way. You shouldn't feel that way about it. You should feel this way about this. Oh, I look at it. So we do that. The second thing is it could be worse. You know, and people will do this all the time where, you know, oh, I just wanted cancer. And then it went like this. And then it went like this. And what's the most disheartening to people, particularly when they're in the throes of it, is, well, when my dad died, or when my friend died, or when my cat died, and particularly if it seems kind of less, and you're making it sound more, and it feels like more to the insecure person who hasn't dealt with their own pain, because, you know, this is just where they've hung their angst. It just is so infuriating. It's so, please go away, you know, kind of feeling. So that it could be worse narrative. It's not good. The next one is just the shame on you narrative, right? That somehow or another, this is your fault. You're reaping what you sow, or your response to it is not appropriate. That if you were really a good Christian, you wouldn't feel this way. Look at this person on Facebook. They're going through way worse, and they're like conference speakers. They're like so good. So shame on you for being where you're at. And there's a ton of that in Job. And then the last one is, I've got to defend God. You're saying things about God that you can't say about God. You can't say that. You can't think that. I've got to defend. And what we think we're doing is defending God, God never asks us to defend him. Just doesn't. you know, we're actually saying I had to defend my theology, because if that's true, what you're saying is true, then my belief system can't be true. And therefore I got to challenge that. And so, again, one of the reasons we're lousy friends to help people who are going through difficult things is we're not in touch with our own insecurities and fear. Because what I really believe, what the main thing that Job's friends felt that was driving them was fear. What if, you know, the questions that Job are asking legitimate? What if my theologies? What if something like this happens to me? What if, you know, and then they're insecure about what their, you know, the concrete structures of reality that they had created that are being challenged when they see Job. This can happen to Job. Well, that must mean that there was parts of Job we didn't understand. And so they just go through this thing of, you know, if you understood God's secret wisdom, if you really were honest about what you had done. Oh, you know what? It was your kids. Your kids actually deserved to die, Job. And then, you know, it's just time for you to wrap your mind around that. And, you know,
what an intense.
Yeah. Thing, can you imagine?
It's despicable.
It is. Yes. Well, and there's a reason why the book ends with it saying, and God's anger burned against Job's friends. So God gets angry at this, that, you know, whatever Job's response was, which again, he never sinned according to the text, and yet he needed to repent. So what's going on there? We'll talk about that in a minute. But what Job's friends is, what Job's friends are doing.
Next episode,
cliffhanger. Next time on the School of Unlearning, Paul will actually do what he said.
Let me just chase this little rabbit here first.
I forgot what we were talking about. So we're talking about Job's friend. They were the worst, weren't they? I forgot what I was going to say.
Sorry. I don't know. I don't know who's...
This might have been the crucial thing.
It was going to
turn people's life around, and now it's lost for the ages. Yeah. Well, anyway, Job's friends, you know... this was it. They're speaking out of their own insecurity. So their image of themselves, their image of reality... was shaken to the core, and they were not at the point that, you know, it's an interesting thing that although they were making it sound like they were defending God and they had this really big God and very clear picture of God, they didn't understand God at all. They didn't understand that we have a God that is so above this. And this is the God who shows up in the whirlwind. He says, there's just things you don't understand, but this is what you should understand is I'm God. I'm really powerful. I really do have a plan. I know how I'm managing things pretty well, you know, I am good. I am loving. Okay. And because of that, it gives you the freedom to question, to rave, to rant, to do those kinds of things. And so, you know, they don't understand that. And because they don't understand that, they have to come back to simplistic, very concrete theology that is very linear. It's just one or two steps. You do bad, bad happens. You do good, good happens. They really don't have a theology that goes much further than that. And it's exact. I mean, it's like weighing out a scale and you know, well, what do you do when the baby dies? What did the baby do? I mean, and we even see this kind of theology trying to, people just grappling with the simplicity of things that are not simple at all. Well, this is the deal for Job. Job, the word repentance very often, we think means stop sinning. It doesn't mean that at all. The both Hebrew and Greek word for repentance is a change of mind. The essence of it is that I was looking at things this way, now I'm looking at things this way. And so what we see at the end of Job is not a repentance of sin. That is to say, I was doing sin, and then I recognized it was a sin, and I stopped the sin because I recognized sin for what it was, I'm calling it in. So it was very clear that he didn't miss the mark. What he was doing was not important. But there was something about the process he went and then the revelation of what he received from God at the end, we're going to talk a little bit more about that this Sunday, that allowed him to get a different perspective, that allowed him to see things differently, that allowed him to make progress, to allowed him to go forward. So he doesn't really get answers about why the suffering happened, about his specific situation. And actually, there's not much about the problem of evil in Job at all in terms of
which is kind of fascinating.
It really is.
The premise set up, you know?
Yes. Oh, great. All right. Let's get to the end. You're reading through Job saying, when is this going to get better? They're gonna come back. And it's just like, you know, but what ends up happening is that Job gets the perspective that allows him to go on. It reminds me very much of the story of Elijah in the cave. Really fascinating story, you know. So you have Elijah, just had this huge spiritual victory. He outplayed the 500 priests of Baal, and yet comes off of that, and he's just tired. And he gets threatened by the Jezebel, so he runs for his life, ends up going to Mount Horeb. Mount Horeb is historically the place for him that Ten Commandments, you'd get fire on the mountain, big God. So he goes to that place because he's looking for the big God. And of course, he goes in the cave and gets asked, you know, what are you doing here? And he says, oh, I'm the only one. He's got a narrative in his head that is imprecise at best and inaccurate and self-pitying and not good. So what does God do? He doesn't yell at him, doesn't scream at him. He says, well, you're going to need to change your perspective. But before you get that, why don't I give you something to eat? Why don't you get some sleep? And that's what happens. And then he wakes up and God says, what are you doing here? And he says the same thing again. So why don't I let you sleep again? Why don't I give you a little something else to eat? And then the third time, what God gives him is an experience of him. He you know, there's an earthquake, God's not on the earthquake, there's fire, God's not on the fire, and then there's the still small voice, which is the opposite of everything Elijah stands for. Because he's the fiery prophet. Mm-hmm. He's got a big God. And things that he believed about God that were very true, but out of balance and imprecise, which is just true of all of our theology.
I was going to say, that's a very, very good way of putting it. And we talk about this often in this podcast, but as modern thinkers, we have to be so careful not to think that we're better.
Theology is right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, by definition, if we're talking about the transcendent God who cannot be understood, then anything we say about God is true very often and accurate to some degree, but it's horribly imprecise.
Yep. And we work off of is based off of what he's chosen to reveal to us.
Yes. Yes.
Which is only the portions he's chosen to reveal to us.
Yes.
You know?
Well, and that's the thing both about Job and about Elisha. Both of them, what were they given? They were given the ability to go forward. They were given the ability to go on. And so, I mean, that's the thing for Job, and that's the things for Job's friends. And so, I mean, kind of pull this all together just a little bit. I think, you know, if you read through Job's friends and you look at what they're actually saying and why they're saying and what their motivation is behind it and what it means. I mean, again, you get them accusing him of bad theology, of being a bad person, to the end that you just get this rant against Job, that you're, you know, it's not only that this bad thing happened to you, but it really was your fault. And you know what? You deserve this. They're saying things you deserved a lot worse. I mean, they just pile on because, you know, their words and their doctrine, some of the doctrine they said is proverbially true. That's the thing that really, but it's misapplied, bad timing. It's not treat as wisdom literature, it's treated as rules and law. I mean, it's like the person who will quote Romans 8 to a person going through a difficult time. You know, that all things work for the good of those who trust God. Well, that's the Bible. So yeah, we believe that. But to use it in that way at that time is cruel. Mm-hmm. It's cruel.
Yeah.
You know,
beyond unhelpful.
Yes, beyond unhelpful. It's actually, you're in Job friends category. You're actually, angering God, you know. So, I mean, and this is the cool thing at the end. Job then is the one who mediates, and they have to go to Job, and Job prays for them, and we'll unpack some of that this weekend. But there's just this thing. The fascinating thing we haven't even talked about is this fourth friend, who's really interesting because he's described as young and angry over and over again. He's the young man who's angry. And again, I tried to bring out this point without being the old curmudgeonly
guy. One was really good.
Yeah, that when you're young, there's just this stage. The developmental psychologist Puget talked about that stage where you're coming of age, you become aware of injustice, and you just become inflamed with justice. And he called it the savior stage. Mm-hmm. And you want to change things. But you haven't got the experience to understand how complex things are, why things are the way they are. that this is really a messy world. You don't have a lot of skin in the game because you don't really own anything. You're not really responsible for anything but yourself. So you're willing to risk a lot more, but you don't really have that much to risk. That is, the other thing is you don't realize what you're risking because you really haven't gone through enough to really appreciate. But then you, you know, one, your brain develops. Two, you're getting some stuff. So you recognize the risk. By stuff, I mean, not just material stuff, but relationships and family. And now your big moves that you're willing to make when you're willing to go on mission trips all over the world are a lot bigger because now it affects more than yourself. And you're recognizing that I thought the path was meaning was going on fighting these crusades, a little Don Quixote windmill kind of stuff, right? But really, the real path for meaning is me, one, managing myself well first, so that I have something to contribute, preparing in such a way that I have something to contribute, care for those immediately around me, my family, and then do something in the world to make the common good. And if more people did that, well, then things would just get a lot better. And then just to understand your capabilities, you know, that as an individual, you're probably not going to solve hunger, but you could be part of something bigger than yourself that really makes, you know, one of the conversations years, I just had this so many times with young people become aware of a problem and they roll in and said, Pastor Paul, are you aware of global trafficking? Yep. Heard of it. Up to speed, you know, and I love they're wonderful. They're really, and I love it and I affirm it and we commiserate in it. Well, what are we going to do? Well, what could you do? You know, and just to understand, you know, the limitation we have that, this just may be one of those things I got to grieve that I can't solve this problem. But here's what I could do. I could find some person affected by whatever I'm inflamed about, illiteracy, foster care, you know, trauma, you know, poverty, illiteracy, whatever. And I could help a person. Mm-hmm. If I helped a person, there's that wonderful rabbinical saying, the one who saves one life saves the whole world. And in that, it's a proverb, so not meant to be a literal law. How does that work? That's not true. That's literally not true. That's figuratively true. And it's metaphorically or proverbially true. The point is that it always comes down to an individual. And it's amazing to me how many people love a cause or love the idea of something. They have an ideology about helping and this can be anything from, you know, pro-life to education, but they don't actually know anybody with the problem and they don't actually help anybody with the problem. Because when you actually get to the individual and the problem, you learn two things. One is it's hard and it's really messy and that there's a reason why people are in these situations. So if you're going to help the individual, it's going to cost you a lot more than just standing for the cause. Anyway, you have this young guy and he's mad because first he's mad at Job for saying these things. And then he's mad at these other guys for not adequately responding to Job. So he's mad at the system. He's mad. It's a microcosm of the age we're in where everybody is mad right now, you know, whether you're on the right or the left. And we have these big ideological ideas and we have these big things we want to fix and it's so broken and we're just angry and we're just ranting. And that's what you get with Elihu. And I think there's just a lesson in that, right? That for us to take a step back and ask, you know, how should I live? Who are the people and the individuals around me that I can live with and love and make things better? I'm afraid that's a lesson that only comes with years. So I think that's why there's so many biblical admonitions about, you know, I mean, you couldn't even be a rabbi in the time of Jesus till you were 30. And they lived, their life expectancy rate was going to be something like mid-30s, early 40s. So the understanding was, you really, before you really start telling anybody anything, you should have lived most of your life. And so, and the Bible talks about not letting a novice become an elder in a church and things like that. And yet the Bible tells you don't let anybody despise your youth and your youth and experience. It does go on to say, but be an example in life and conduct and speech. So let your actions speak. It doesn't just say, don't let anybody talk to you like that, you know, but help them see that you're living beyond your age. So anyway, we could chase this a lot, but
it's good.
Yeah. So again, you know, if you're out there right now and you're in a Job-like situation where you just said, boy, that I just feel like I've had a lot of Job's friends. Let me just say I'm sorry that that happened. And, you know, it's part of what we're trying to do as our church. We're just trying to be better at it. We're trying to do emotionally healthy stuff. We're trying to help people process and integrate their faith into what they're happening, good, what has happened to them, good theology of pain and suffering, family of origins, genograms, all those things. Be a student of yourself, be aware, create an inner life, do spiritual disciplines that allow you to pay attention to what you're feeling and thinking and expressing, contemplative practices. We're trying to do better. So I'm sorry that happened to you. I do want to encourage you to just keep pursuing, you know, God in an honest pursuit of what your healing looks like. Don't embrace, don't just transfer your angst to, well, people suck and the church sucks. And there's a danger of a bitterness there that will not serve you well. It'll feel immediately satisfying and permission giving to not make progress. Just be careful of that. Mm. If you are a person who's trying to figure out how to get close to a person who's hurting, you know, I just encourage you to think deeply, read through Job, and then just be willing to, don't fall in the trap saying, well, I'm not going to go near that. I'm just going to withdraw. Because I think a lot of people do that. I don't want to mess it up. I don't want to hurt anybody. Because people don't want to hurt people. I don't want to hurt anybody. I mean, feel that deeply. But just go. Learn how to ask questions. Learn how to just be. Learn how to just be comfortable with the awkwardness. Be willing to take a few unfair comments and punches that people, when they're hurting, they say things stronger than they mean. They'll push you away. I remember my mom when my dad died, you know, she would beg us to come visit her. The minute we were in the door, she was asking us to leave. I mean, it was just, that was just the deal. That was the deal. And we just did that. We understood that. And that's a very common deal, you know. So just enter into it. You know, if another person's pain has stirred up your pain, this is why we do emotionally healthy church. This is why we do trauma reboot. This is why we do, you know, write laments. So there's just some pathways to healing and, just being better human beings in this whole thing on the craziness of life. And that's the gift of Job, right? It gives us permission. And I don't know, again, the big thing with Job is not understanding as much as it's resonating. And it's permission giving to just be in this messy process. There are other books and there are other theologies that do speak to the problem of evil. There's actually really good answers to why evils in the world and mm-hmm. and where that comes from and all that kind of stuff. Those kinds of conversations almost never help a hurting person. Mm-hmm. They almost never help a hurting person. So, all right, should we pray?
Yeah.
All right. God, you're good. We love you. We believe you're good. We believe you have a plan. That's why we can, in faith, express our hurt, our pain, our disappointment, our fears, why we can say really hard things that if we're honest, we're already thinking, we're already feeling, and we can bring that forward. Help us to just trust you with that kind of radical trust and trust that you'll meet us in that, because what we're looking for is you. Help us to be good friends, friends who will be present, who will not come with so many words or desire to fix or just push people to go forward faster than they can, but just wise, discerning people who know what to say, what not to say, when to lean in, when to take a step back. Give us humility to understand that there are times when we're not the person to help. We're not the person to be there. Or that the big thing is going to come from another source. Holy Spirit, this is why we're so grateful that God didn't just send us a manual, but he sent us you to walk with us and guide us. And so lead us in this. In Jesus' name. Amen.